From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall at cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 420 of Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin and we're broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa. And we'll be taking your calls very soon at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, and 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. Encourage you to call in early and we'll get to your calls and answer them as thoroughly as possible for you to use in future conversations regarding your health with your healthcare professional. And I had a couple of things I wanted to bring up. I wasn't sure which one or whether I was going to bring up both of them in terms of what has happened this past week, but we'll see where we go with this. The first has to do with pharmacists prescribing. Now, I've been on record saying I thought this wasn't a bad thing per se, as long as guidelines were followed and record keeping was done and that there was open communication between the pharmacist and the physician and that there was adequate follow-up for patients to ensure that a renewed prescription, for example, for a blood pressure medication that's being renewed, say, a year after the previous prescription, that there was adequate follow-up, that the patient required blood pressure to be taken again, kidney function to be done, and in some cases also cholesterol levels and other things that might be necessary because of the medications that are being taken. But that being said, this week, firsthand knowledge from a colleague of mine who works in my practice of a situation for one of their patients that has diabetes. And in this case, the person was experiencing low blood sugar effects during the day that was quite uncomfortable for the patient and was possibly harmful if not rectified. And so this person was taking a particular medication called a particular medication that you take once a day, two tablets once a day. And this particular medication, which is a sulfonylurea, it's a class of medication that stimulates the pancreas to produce more insulin to try and help blood sugar levels to go down. And so my colleague writes back, as the pharmacist is saying, well, you know, we should change this medication or we should, you know, alter the dosing. And the pharmacist actually had informed the physician that this patient was having low blood sugar levels, which is a good thing. And the pharmacist said, well, I think I'm going to change the patient to a different medication. Pharmacist says this, to a medication, similar class, same sulfonylurea, and give this medication twice a day. And the physician in our office writes back and says, no, I don't think that's a good idea. I'd rather reduce the dose of medication to once a day, just one tablet, and see what happens. And the pharmacist countermands that and actually gives the patient a twice-a-day dosing of medication, to which the physician has to write back and say, no, I want that patient, my patient, to have one dose of that medication a day. So there's an obvious problem here where you have the physician who is there's a term called the person most responsible for care. And in this case, it happens to be the physician, pretty much under most circumstances, that is responsible for the patient's care. So in the event that the pharmacist changes the dose against the wishes of what the physician recommends, and this is now documented for our listeners. We have this documented in our office, this whole interchange. So I am not embellishing anything in this particular example. And if for perchance that patient experienced more hypoglycemia, became dizzy and fell, who would now be responsible? Would it be the pharmacist or would it be the physician? It's an area that really we don't want to get into. We'd rather just have, you know, if a decision is being made and the physician is considered most responsible under the law, then what the physician has requested of the pharmacist to do in terms of changing the dose should be the final say. The pharmacist can certainly express their reservations and give recommendations, but that's what they are recommendations. You can't make that decision for that patient, especially when you do not know the patient very well. You don't have any recent blood work to know how that patient has been faring with regards to their blood sugar. So again, it's a matter of having a complete history and all the data to make a decision. And in this case, this was quite disconcerting for the physician because it really interfered with their ability to manage the patient under conditions where they know the patient very well. They know what medications they're taking. They know other factors that are involved in their care. And to have to go through multiple interchanges, usually by fax, to get this stuff done, not only is a time-consuming process, but also an unnecessary process. It should have stopped right at the point where the physician said, I would like to reduce the dose to one tablet a day of this particular medication, and not have the pharmacist change the medication and say the patient is going to take twice a day of this. It was completely unnecessary, and really, in my view, not the best way to treat and manage patients and provide patient care. So hopefully this is an isolated incident and not something that is going on a regular basis. So I just thought I'd bring that particular issue up. And the other issue had to do with our experience in the office of lack of support from various areas and disciplines in the city, primarily psychiatric care for our patients. Psychiatric patients that are in crisis, that are presenting themselves to the emergency room, who are suicidal and essentially turned away from the hospital, being told that somehow their situation is not as serious, when we know and have made recommendations that they do go to the hospital because we're concerned about their health. And in fact, there was one instance of a patient of mine where I recommended that they go to the emergency room because of their condition. They have bipolar disorder. And I was concerned that their life was in jeopardy. And they went to one particular hospital and essentially was told that, made to feel that she was not being considered seriously, and told that there was really nothing much that was wrong. And it was a long, sordid affair. She spent about 10 hours at the hospital and felt humiliated afterwards. Thankfully, she went to a different hospital and she was admitted for a while because they did recognize that she was suicidal and did receive some treatment. But this is an ongoing problem where we have teenagers that are suicidal, we have people who are suffering with mental illness, and the resources out there are constrained, but at the same time, there is no support for primary care physicians to provide urgent care for their psychiatric patients. And this also extends to other patients who have other conditions as well. I have a couple of patients I've known for over 20 years. They are now in their late 70s. One of them has a type of rheumatoid arthritis and has had a hip replacement, and she is also scheduled to get knee replacement. She's incapacitated for the moment. She's in chronic pain. They live on the Quebec side, and so it is very difficult to find services in Quebec for them because, frankly, I find that trying to get any services in the Outaouais area is extremely difficult for those patients, and it's frustrating when you know what needs to be done and it cannot be done. Her husband, who is 77 years old, he's 78 years old, he recently had a knee replacement done. And he left hospital after 3 days in order to go care for his wife after his knee replacement, and with no real services at home to help them. And he was helping his wife and transferring his wife from bed to wheelchair to the bathroom to helping her get dressed, all on a knee that had been operated on 3 days ago. 3 days ago, in terms of when this was done, and amazingly, he has done quite well and his knee has healed up. But again, these are isolated issues, but I am sure that these are stories that happen every single day. And because they are not sexy stories, They aren't things that pop out. They don't get much media coverage. But I can bet you that there are a lot of people in our community that are suffering under similar circumstances, and their family physicians are doing what they can to keep things together. But at the same time, the support that is supposed to be out there is at times seemingly non-existent. And it creates an extreme amount of frustration for everybody, because it's like you know what the path that you have to take to be well, and yet there are roadblocks along that path that you can't control. And as a result, you have no other solution, because you have this path in order to help your patient, and yet there is no ability to take a detour. There is no extra road. The path that you have to take is the path that is required, and yet there are roadblocks up there that prevent that type of care. And it's been an extremely frustrating week for many of us at the office who have faced this for our patients. If you have any comments about that, any stories that you may have regarding roadblocks and difficulties within the system, I'd be interested in hearing about that. And also your calls about any other topic as well, 521-TALK, 521-8255. Star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call, and we will be back in a couple of minutes.
580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
Talk 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. We have lots of lines available and looking forward to speaking with you today. And we are going to go to line one and say hello to Brian in Richmond.
Hello? Hi, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
I was calling regarding, I heard some time ago on your show that I'm trying to quit smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like a fake cigarette you got bought someplace.
Yeah, electronic cigarettes.
Electronic cigarettes.
Yes.
Okay. Where can I get them, or do you have a name for them? Or?
Yeah, you can. It's a very straightforward thing to do. You can simply just go on Google and put Electronic Cigarettes Canada.
Okay.
And then you'll get a whole bunch of different websites that have some of the websites I wasn't too enamored with, just in terms of their lack of information. There are a few others. I don't want to use any particular name because
right.
I don't want to support one over the other.
Right.
But it would be very easy for you to tell which one was the goods, which ones provided the information, which ones didn't.
Okay.
And in fact, in my office for one of my patients who is trying to quit, we went online and we actually ordered from the office the electronic cigarettes for them to try.
Right.
And we're going to see how that works. But It is a method that is being used, and for some people it works quite well because it mimics the habit of having something in your hand, and
right.
and you know it molds in or melds in with the person's pattern of behavior
right.
as a means of reducing the cigarette smoke and just having the nicotine delivered to them instead.
Right.
So I don't see right now in terms of. Risk and benefit. I certainly don't see them as being more risky than the actual cigarettes, considering
right.
what's contained in cigarettes.
Yep.
But yeah, you just do a search like that, and you'll find a bunch of Canadian sites that are selling them. And it's amazing the varieties. There are some that have the technology incorporated in them where there's even a little LED screen on there, an LCD screen that tells you how many cigarettes worth of nicotine, what's left in the cartridge, like how many cigarettes you have left or how many puffs you have left. It's actually quite interesting as a means of keeping track of the smoking. And it also, for those that are interested, it comes in different flavors. You wouldn't believe the flavors that are with it. There's regular tobacco flavor and there's fruit flavors. It's actually very interesting to see how it's being marketed, whether, you know, whether it actually helps people or not, is still, you know, has to be looked at. But it there's a market out there and people are buying it.
Right, right.
How long have you been smoking?
About 50 years.
A long time. What has led to this decision?
I've developed a bit of COPD.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at the doctor, in July. I went back just last month, and my lungs have improved. I've cut back considerably, mm-hmm. and exercised more.
That's good.
And it's down 15%, or my lungs have improved 15%.
It made the exercise especially makes a huge difference in COPD in terms of improving lung capacity.
Right.
And as well, the most important thing you can do is to stop, because what will happen is that you will have areas of your lung that will recover.
Right.
Some parts of the lung that have been damaged are permanently damaged.
I mean, right.
We can't beat around the bush that way. So
right.
there is emphysema, and there are areas where the oxygen is not transferred very well.
Right.
But your lungs are quite resilient, and if you give them a chance, you'll find your quality of life will improve dramatically.
Right.
So the electronic cigarettes will not worsen your COPD. That's the main thing.
Right. Right.
And if that's a means for you to reduce the actual smoke itself, I'd say, sure, you know, I would speak to your doctor, obviously, to see if there's anything with regards to anything else you might be doing. I can't think of anything per se, given that the cigarettes are being used anyway.
Right, yeah.
But it's still good to have your physician know what the plan is and what you're planning to do. Have you spoken to them about that at all?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, so it's probably a good idea, because it's good for them to know that you're trying something and what you're trying.
Right.
And they can also follow up with you, too. You know, it's certainly a worthwhile endeavor. It's also good to have the support.
Right, right, right.
But it is, for COPD is, they're expecting in the next, where are we now, 2012, within the next 8 years, it will be, it's already one of the leading causes of admission to hospital, but it's going to be even more of a reason for people ending up in hospital because of the, again, it's people that have been smoking for 50, 40, 50, or 60 years. This is what you're seeing now,
right,
are these
right.
admissions to hospital for it. But I think it's great that you're being proactive about it and wanting to stop. And any by any means available, it's as long as you get rid of the cigarette, you know, that right now is the priority. And I think that's great that you're trying to do that.
Oh, great. All right, doctor. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Brian, and good luck.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, bye-bye. 521 Talk, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And we'll say a good afternoon to Christine in Montreal. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Not too bad. Quick question for you.
Sure.
My son, at least I'm assuming anyway, looks like he's getting chicken pox.
Okay.
But I'm wondering exactly what they kind of look like.
Chicken pox have what we call a fried egg appearance. So if you think of a fried egg with the yolk in the middle and the white around it, and that gets fried up, chicken pox looks exactly like that. It's a tiny little fluid-filled bubble that's surrounded with a red, rosy ring. And if you were to look at it as a fried egg, it would look like exactly that. And they tend to be scattered different parts of the body, and then you literally see an explosion of chicken pox in itself over a period of a day or two, where you have a lot more of those poxes come up.
Okay, because last night when he went to bed, it looked like he had nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then this morning he got up and he's got little red dots with a darker spot in the middle, like scattered on his body.
And do they look like little vesicles or fluid-filled things? Or
they look like pimples, yeah, in the center
of
them.
It's very possible that's what it is. Did he have a chicken pox shot at all?
He did.
Oh, okay. Well, how long ago was that?
He's only five, so...
And did he get a booster at all at four, or did he have two shots or one shot?
I think it was two.
Okay, because usually they get a chicken pox shot at around 15 months, and given that he's close to five, he probably had a chicken pox shot when he was a year old
not too
or something.
Long ago,
yeah.
So.
What you may see if it is chicken pox and he has had the vaccine, you are likely not to have the full blown effect of chicken pox. There are some kids, if they only partially respond to the vaccine, they end up they end up, instead of getting the average of over 300 or 350 pox marks, they end up with about 30 or 40 of them. So about 10% of it. So they're not as ill with the vaccine. So if anything, it'll protect them and have less of an effect. But as with any rash, it's very difficult without seeing it to know exactly what it is. So you want to look for any pattern if it continues to spread. And it tends to be scattered. So chickenpox tends to scatter over the body with no specific pattern, whereas other types of rashes may have a specific pattern to it. But if it is chickenpox, Christine, they won't have as much of a problem because they had that vaccine.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
And we're going to take a small break for the news. And when we come back, we have Diane in Ottawa has a question of what test to take in, I guess, a physical exam. And that's a favorite topic of mine because that question varies according to age. So we're going to get into that. And other questions you might have, 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back right after the news. Give me the news. I got a bad case
loving you. The advice and recommendations in this program are for general educational purposes and not a diagnosis. You should consult a physician or health professional directly before beginning or changing any course of health treatment. 580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever when you kiss me, fever when you hold me tight. Fever in the morning, fever all through the night.
521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. We have lots of lines available. If you call in now, you will get on the air. And we are going to go to line one and say hello to Diane in Ottawa.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay, I'm calling not for me exactly, but for my husband.
Okay.
Because a few times he's been for annual, and then we realized that certain other tests should have been done and they were forgotten. So I thought this time, let's get it right.
Okay.
He's 70 years old. He's pre-diabetic, which means that he tests his sugar and he's got to be careful.
Okay.
He's not onto needles or nothing like that. It's just, you know, he's got to be careful.
Okay.
And I know he's taking medication for, it can't come to me. Anyway, nothing like close to diabetic. So what are the tests that he should be asking for when he goes for his general annual?
Okay. Does he smoke?
Yes.
He does. Okay. And you said he is pre-diabetic, so he is taking some medications, or he's not?
None. He just monitors his blood.
Okay.
That's it.
And does he have high blood pressure?
No.
Okay. So the first things to do is when you go by a person's age, and the first thing when you look at the different tests that need to be done. And so when we're looking at screening, that is trying to do tests to determine whether it's going to show something that can be treated, and if it's treated early, they have a better outcome. So the things that a person should be should have had by now at age 70 is a screening test for colon cancer. So I don't know if he's had that or not, if he's had a colonoscopy or not in the past.
No.
So that's one thing that he should have done.
Okay.
His blood.
And can he go just by the little cards?
He needs to, well, the cards themselves, the what we call the fecal occult blood testing, is not the greatest test to do.
Okay.
It's not as accurate as a colonoscopy with regards to detecting colon cancer.
Okay.
It's also not, doesn't tell you anything about whether somebody has polyps or whether those polyps are precancerous. So a colonoscopy tends to be a much better test in order to detect the potential for colon cancer, as opposed to doing the card test where you're doing the looking for blood in the stool.
But if the doctor backs off on that, and I know because he's asked for it before, and the doctor said, well, you've got no symptoms, I don't see the need for doing that.
Well, I think then you should have that discussion with the physician to say that I would like to have the colonoscopy done. The physician really, you know, has to give a reasonable answer. And the fact of the matter is that in terms of standard of care, colonoscopy is considered to be a standard of care in terms of a screening test. So there is no reason why somebody should not get a colonoscopy if they want, first of all, want one, or if the physician is recommending one, to go ahead and do it. So just because the physician says, I don't think you need one, there isn't much evidence for them to say that. And that's the main thing. They have to cite evidence of why they don't want to do the colonoscopy. So my preference is to do colonoscopies as opposed to fecal occult blood testing. And I usually do a colonoscopy starting at age 50, or if there is a family history of colon cancer at an early age, we'll usually do colonoscopies at an earlier age in order to try and find something. So that's the first thing. The second is to make sure to take his blood pressure, his weight and height as well. Tobacco use in order for him to stop smoking, because in terms of his health, right? You can do all the tests in the world to try and find things, but the ideal thing is to say, you know, what can we do to improve a person's health in a dramatic way? And the cigarettes obviously would be a huge benefit to stop in terms of his risk of heart disease. He's pre-diabetic. Effects on lung function. We had a caller earlier who had COPD, who's trying to stop smoking because his lung function has actually improved by cutting down on his cigarettes, and he's exercising more. Other things, his cholesterol level, if it hasn't been done yet. If he has a cholesterol level that was done within the past few years, it is not necessary to do again, because cholesterol levels don't change very much at all on a year-to-year basis.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And again, when taking the cholesterol level, it's important to know what the blood pressure is like, because in terms of calculating his 10-year risk of developing heart disease, you're going to want to have, you need all these factors. The fact that he smokes also increases his risk of heart attack. So that goes into the equation of determining his overall risk, and then determining whether he needs a medication to treat his cholesterol level, based on those factors.
Okay.
There are certain vaccines that he needs. So, for example, if he hasn't had a tetanus diphtheria shot in the past 10 years, he'll need
that.
Tetanus and diphtheria. It's called the TD shot.
Okay.
TD vaccine. It usually is given every 10 years.
Okay.
Another vaccine that's usually given at the age of 65 is a vaccination for pneumonia, and it's called Pneumovax, or there's the pneumonia vaccine. There is now an optional but recommended vaccine for pneumonia in conjunction with the Pneumovax that's called Prevnar. Prevnar, P-R-E-V-N-A-R. This particular vaccine is also a vaccine that's used to prevent severe pneumonias in older folks. It's used in children routinely as part of their routine vaccinations when they're young.
Okay.
But the indication is now there for people over 65 to have this vaccine. It's not covered, though. So it does cost approximately $110 for that particular vaccine.
Okay.
But it is given just once.
Okay.
Another vaccine.
Life, you mean?
For life.
I mean you wouldn't need one every year.
No. It's just for life. You get that one dose and that's it.
Oh, okay.
The other vaccination that is recommended for everybody over the age of 50, but primarily for those over 60, is a vaccination to prevent shingles.
Oh, yeah. If you haven't had the measles, though, it's funny because I was just about to ask a doctor this week. If you haven't had the measles, though.
It's not measles. It's shingles. Oh, it's chicken pox.
Yeah, chicken pox. If you haven't had them, are you still at a disadvantage to get shingles?
Well, there is a way to find out whether you've had chicken pox or not. And the way to find out is a blood test that'll look for antibodies that would be there if you had chicken pox in the past. It means your body has reacted to the virus. Most people have had chicken pox. It's very rare to see people that haven't had it. And especially so if someone has not had chicken pox. If you do get chicken pox as an adult, it's much more severe.
Maybe the better way is just get the needle.
Well, it is recommended to get, because that would protect you, because it is essentially a souped up chicken pox vaccine, which is
So regardless if you've had it or not.
Right.
Okay, that sounds good.
So that's another thing that would be done. In terms of other blood tests, usually at this point, if he has a problem with blood pressure or prediabetes, you would do tests to check his kidney function. So the test that's done for that is called a creatinine test. Another test that's done is something called an ACR, or albumin creatinine ratio. I know it's getting technical, but essentially it's just kidney tests. You would tell your physician And your physician should be doing that anyway as part of the overall evaluation, because doing a complete physical exam on someone who, and we're talking about people who are otherwise healthy, doesn't tell us very much. But because he smokes, right, you're likely going to want to listen to the lungs. It's probably a good idea to do what we call a pulmonary function test, because you want to see the state of his lungs, how well he's able to breathe, you know, right, and it gives us an idea of how damaged the lungs are. So
pulmonary.
It's called a PFT, pulmonary function test.
Okay.
So that sort of encapsulates, you know, some of the things that are done. Other things that are done, frankly, are making sure that he wears his seatbelts properly, because a lot of people do not, right? So if I were to ask someone, or if I were to ask you, for example, how do you put on your seatbelt, how would you respond?
I tie it. I put it around my body and I tie it.
Right. So most people say that, but what they don't do, and they do that, they even just show in the office, they'll go, oh yeah, I just pull it down and I clip it in. Well, the lap part of the belt actually has to be in a specific notch in your hip. And when you feel your hip, there's a little notch just below the bump on the front of your, you know, you feel your hip bone in the front?
Right.
Just under that is where the seatbelt is supposed to go, because that's a natural notch in there. So that if you're in a car accident, which is a very common thing, and also a risk to someone's health, if you're in a car accident and your seatbelt is sitting over your stomach or over your abdomen, and you're in an accident, that seatbelt can actually crush your intestine and your bladder, because of the force of impact.
Right.
So your bladder can, if your bladder tends to be filled with urine at the time of impact, it can burst.
Okay.
So, but if your seatbelt is below that area and lodged into the pelvis, that won't happen. So it's, again, it's just simple things to ask people, because if we're looking to prevent disease or prevent illness or damage, that's an important thing to ask someone. Other things that to make sure about are his vision, making sure that his vision is correct.
Yeah, that he gets done apart every year, once a year, and his ears as well.
Right. So those are some of the things that would be done at that particular checkup. And again, for him, in terms of physical exam, you know, if he's coming in, I know he had pre-diabetes, or he had, he's not being treated though for diabetes.
No, it's just borderline.
Okay, so
as long as he eats well and does exercise, because he's very sedentary. So as long as he exercises, even an hour a day does it, he maintains.
Okay. What I would also recommend in terms of another blood test is something called a fasting insulin test.
Fasting
insulin.
Okay.
And the reason for that is that in people who have prediabetes, they can have normal blood sugars.
Right.
But the reason they have normal blood sugars is if they are producing, say, for example, when you have type 2 diabetes, the reason you have type 2 diabetes is that the insulin doesn't work as well anymore.
Right.
So you need more insulin to have the same effect.
Right.
So someone that may be pre-diabetes, they may have fasting insulins that are very high. But when you do the regular blood test to look for their blood sugar, it'll say your blood sugar seems to be okay. And the reason it's okay is that your insulin is very high. But what that tells us, if you have an insulin level that's very high, is that your pancreas, the organ that's responsible for making that hormone, is really working hard to keep that blood sugar down, and it can exhaust it. And so ideally, for people who are in that situation where they have very high fasting insulins, the recommendations are obviously for weight loss, but also in some instances, and this involves a discussion again with the physician, in some instances, you would treat them for diabetes because that insulin was high, to try and get that insulin level to come back down again.
Okay.
So again, it's a way of preventing something from occurring as opposed to waiting for it to occur.
Okay.
So that sort of gives you a lot of material to work with, Diane.
Okay, what about the prostate cancer?
Screening for prostate cancer, frankly, from all the evidence that is out there, is not helpful.
No.
Doing a PSA is not, you will with PSAs find some men that have prostate cancer, but the evidence is that you will have many more men that you do this test on that end up having all kinds of procedures done on them that are unnecessary and will cause a lot of harm. And in terms of outcome, there is little evidence to suggest that a PSA test in an otherwise healthy male will increase their lifespan if you find that they have prostate cancer. So those came from two big studies in the New England Journal of Medicine several years ago that actually looked at that. And essentially the statistics were that for every 1,400 healthy men in their 60s that you did a PSA test on, 48 would have a positive test. But of those 48 that you did all sorts of procedures that may have ended up in impotence or damage, only one would have prostate cancer. And of that one that had prostate cancer, they didn't live any longer than whether you did the test or not. So that was the problem. They're always going to have exceptions to the rule, but as a test, it's not a great screening test at all.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome, Diane. You too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. All our lines are available, so if you do call in, we'll be able to get you on just before the end of the show and answer your question. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and we will be back in a couple of minutes.
580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
And we're going to head right back to the phone lines. And a good afternoon to Irene in Ottawa. Hi, Irene.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I would like to know, because I read this somewhere, mm-hmm. that if you have chicken pox as a child
right.
and shingles as an adult, that you should not get the vaccine. Is that right?
No, that's not. I mean, there's a gray zone to that. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices in the United States, their statement is that they recommend a single dose of the vaccine for any adult over the age of 60 who had shingles, regardless of whether they reported it or not. So the fact is that you should be getting one. Now, the caveat to that is that it's unclear that if you have the vaccine, say you have shingles, you had shingles less than 4 years ago, then
yes.
it's unclear whether you're going to have a benefit from the vaccine because it's so close to the time that you had it. However, anything past that four-year mark seems to be very, very helpful. So if you had shingles 5 years ago or 6 years ago, then yes, the recommendation would stand. If it was less than 4 years ago, no harm in having the vaccine, but whether you're going to have a benefit from it is problematic. So that's where the gray zone is.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Irene.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. And we're going to go to line two and Kim in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Good. I have a quick question. I'm experiencing, not all the time, some discomfort under the kind of behind my ribs on the right-hand side, lower down on the rib.
Okay.
It's not always. It started about two months ago.
Right.
And it went away.
Mm-hmm.
And now it seems to be coming back more often. And I think it's actually worse when I eat or after I eat.
Okay. Now, when you say is it now on the front of the ribs or is it on the side? If you're to sort of, it's hard on the radio to describe things, but if you look at your breastbone and
yes.
take the bottom tip of that breastbone and then okay. say, how far to the right from that breastbone do you normally feel that pain?
So if I grab my left thumb, put it on the center of my breastbone.
Yeah.
And then go down, the tall finger is touching it.
Mm-hmm. So towards your right.
Towards my right.
Yeah. So you said you get pain there after you eat.
Mostly after I eat, yes.
Okay. And how long does the pain last?
It's not even constant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, it depends on the position I sit.
Okay.
If I were to sneeze during that time, it really hurts.
It does. Okay. does the pain radiate anywhere else, though? When you have that pain,
no.
It just stays in that area.
Yes.
When you press on the area with your hand, does it make it hurt? When it is hurting, when you do that, does it make it hurt?
No.
Okay. Well, there's again, without doing a complete exam, but from what you're describing, especially if you tend to see this happen when you eat. Now, you've never had surgery, never had anything done in the past, anything?
Not in that area. I've had surgeries, but I've not had anything in that area.
Okay. And how old are you, by the way?
I'm 46.
Okay, so that's about the right age for this. So you if I were to make a list of differential diagnoses of what you might have, you have to think of your gallbladder. And the reason is that when you eat a meal, especially a meal, and you may even want to test this out, the more oily or fatty a meal, the worse it would get. And the reason is your gallbladder contracts when you eat in order to excrete or secrete bile that is stored in the gallbladder. Bile is required to help. It literally helps mix oil and water together, so it aids in digestion. And so it's secreted and it goes down into the intestine to help mix with the fatty meal. So the more fat the meal has, the more the gallbladder will contract and the more pain someone will usually experience. But the fact that this seems to happen when you eat is a clue. It's not definitive, but certainly a clue and worth further evaluation. Other things that can cause pain in that area, it can be rib pain, especially if you find it hurts when you sneeze. You can have what's called costochondral pain, costo referring to rib, chondral refers to cartilage. And our ribs, we think that they're all bone, but they're not. In fact, a portion of your rib where you put your thumb and extend it to the right, a portion of that part of the rib is cartilage and not bone. And where the rib and the cartilage meet sometimes, you can end up with some inflammation or damage. It could happen from having had a cough or a sudden move or sneezing and the ribs get damaged or the tissue around the ribs get damaged. It can cause that pain. So what I would suggest, just to be sure, is to see your physician, because I'm not happy that when you eat, you get that pain. And it's a very simple matter of finding out whether it's the gallbladder or not. An ultrasound will usually tell us if there's stones. And then from that, you can then determine on the next course of action. But it's worthwhile checking out, Kim, because we have no...
I see my doctor in 2 weeks.
Perfect.
So that's fine.
All right.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Let us know what happens. I'm curious.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye now. My apologies to Len and Shawville. We have run out of time. Thanks to Ted Raymond for producing another edition of Sunday House Call. We will be back actually in 2 weeks because I believe there's a 67s hockey game next Sunday. You've been listening to Sunday House Call. Have a great week.